Agriculture and Natural Resources. This morning we're going to start with a hearing on Senate Bill 95. And so I'm going to ask Judith if she will explain that, and we'll see if we can't get started here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Senate Bill 95 comes to us from our Vice Chair, Senator Beyer. The measure exempts reusable syringes used in animal husbandry from infectious waste disposal requirements. We do have a no revenue and a no fiscal impact statement received on the measure. This relates to ORS Chapter 459, in which the collection, transportation, storage, treatment, and disposal of infectious wastes are regulated. Sharps currently includes all sorts of needles, and this bill specifically excludes the reusable portion of syringes used with detachable disposable needles in animal husbandry from that definition of sharps. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Judith. It looks like we have several people that want to testify on this. I'm going to just ask Nora if she'll come first. I don't want to mispronounce your last name. So would you? Well, you're going to get a chance to say that for everybody, so that we can. I'll have you give your name for the public record. The fine Irish name.
Out of the O'Shalisky clan.
Yes. Of the O'Shalisky clan. I see. Well, Nora, we're glad you're here. If you give your name for the record, I'd like to hear a little bit about your desire for the bill. I know that Senator Beyer introduced it at your request, so.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Let's get started.
Senator Beyer. My name is Nora Shalisky. I operate a business called Unique Suffolk. I raise registered Suffolk sheep, and I'm trying to make money at it. I realize there's an investment period, but one of my obstacles is the current Sharps law. All of the vaccinations that I give are under the direction of my veterinarian. I want you to know that I am health conscious. I was among the first flocks in Oregon to join the federal Scrapie program and was certified Scrapie free as the fourth flock in Oregon, and I think I was like the 10th flock in the nation. So I've maintained that kind of health standard. My sheep receive some regular vaccines, just like a dog or cat would, tetanus being one of them. A yearly shot. This is the Sharps container that I get from my garbage collection service. And you probably cannot see, but it says I can only fill it to this amount. Because last year I ran into a ewe who had a large weight triplets, she got a disease called pregnancy toxemia. And one of the things that I had to do, besides get my veterinarian down and run blood work, was administer 20 cc shots twice a day of a product called calcium phosphatase. The syringe itself is this big, and I think if you can see, multiply that by 6 twice a day. I was filling one of these up every day and a half. It costs me $16.35 to have my Sharps container collected. This is the only thing on a Sharps container that is actually sharp. This is my needle part. And it is easily removed from the plastic syringe. I brought for you today also one that I use. There's 4 sizes of syringes that I typically use. This is one that I gave an antibiotic shot to a ewe. It was used. You can see, or if you want to look more closely, there's nothing left in it. I contacted, first of all, last year, Diane Merriweather at the State Department of Health, and she said that perhaps even something called a statutory remedy could have been made. My concern is not for the sharp part of the sharps. I 100% understand that. But monetarily, at $16.35, plus add in my vet costs and everything else, it's really prohibitive to me. The only other information that I can give you is that this law is not being fairly run, as far as I'm concerned, throughout the state. And I cite Multnomah County, where you buy your initial Sharps container, and from there on out, you just exchange them. You can take them to their waste disposal area yourself and not have that problem. Pacific Sanitation in Marion County is the garbage service that's assigned to my area, and they will not let me take it myself to the Marion County waste disposal area, nor will they provide me with a larger container. And if I were to go out and buy a larger container myself, they would be charging me more to empty it. So that's my concern, my problem, and I hope you have a solution for me.
Are there questions?
Yeah,
go ahead, Senator Fisher.
What's the ability to reuse those syringes?
If I reuse a syringe, I boil, well, I take it apart and boil it, but I only reuse them one time. And that's my own personal, I feel like the minute, you know, I can put them in the boiling water and I can take them out and I can keep them on a paper towel or in a plastic bag, but in reality, I'm exposing them to, you know, the air. They're not as sanitary once they come out of their containers. So I don't reuse them more than once. Reuse is not my primary concern on the syringe part. It's getting rid of them. If I were to put this in the garbage, according to my understanding of the law, I'm up to a $500 fine where there's nothing, absolutely nothing sharp about it.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I realize I was raised in the Stone Age, but I'll guarantee you when we were given penicillin shots to the cows, we weren't worried about one use of the sharps or one use of the syringe. It got filled as fast as we could fill it and use one cow after cow after cow until it either got bent or we were done.
I understand.
And I don't recall ever having any grave problems from it.
Well, this is my personal decision, and I raise sheep for breeding, not for eating. I sell them clear back to Ohio. So I take special care of mine. I don't have a lot, and, you know, it's just a personal choice. As far as the needle, the sharp part, I would hate to use it more than three times because they do get dull.
Mr. Chair, follow up.
Yes.
Maybe you can enlighten me. What is the reason that the syringe or the holding part has to go in the sharps container? What's the logic behind it?
It's my understanding the law reads needle and syringe. I don't know originally when this law came into being. I can tell you that I was in violation of it 5 years ago because I did not know that you had to put this part in. So I was only putting needles in until they came out with some papers in the newspaper saying needle and syringe, and I called and checked on it. I think originally these were all one unit and could not come apart, and that may have been the reason. I don't know.
Mr. Chair.
It says the word in it, I think.
Yes, Senator.
That's what I was going to say. It's my knowledge that there are some that are fixed now that you can't.
This might appear to be fixed now, but when you take it out of its sanitary container, all you have to do is this, and this is the part that I would put in the Sharps container if I had my way.
Yeah, I was meaning as far as maybe even for the medical, for humans, that there is
there may be one piece.
And I guess see that. That's still getting a little far-fetched. But
My source for the syringes and needles is my veterinarian. But I do buy them in the boxes instead of individually.
Right.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Perhaps we can wait until someone from DEQ on
list, and it appears that, you know, we've got in the bill that a sharps does not include the reusable portion of syringes with detachable needles and animal husbandry, but it looks like the wording right in front of that in statute is why the catch is coming. Maybe we ask them if this is the best fix or if there'd be another way to just eliminate the other wording.
Yeah. Okay, well, listen, thank you for your time, and we'll continue here. Next person on our list is Katie Fast.
Thank you, Chair Shields. For the record, Katie Fast, representing the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. We'd like to add our support to this bill. As you heard testimony earlier, there's an issue with you get these from your garbage disposal company in the pickup. Much of our membership is in Eastern Oregon, and they don't have garbage service in Jordan Valley in the outer areas. So this requires a trip to a more metropolitan area like Ontario or Burns to do the pickup and the disposal. These items are easily disinfected as well. There is very little concern over cross-contamination from livestock vaccination products to human contact. I'd be happy to answer any questions from there.
You just mentioned something of interest to me. The only logical thing I could think of would be that the syringes have some kind of contaminant that would be transferable to humans, and is that why you think they're part of the law at this point?
I think they're part of the law currently due to human use. Syringes that are used for human contact. My thought is probably at the time of the law, that the livestock use probably wasn't taken into consideration. When you give a vaccination, the piece of contact would be the needle, and that would be removed, and the syringe would be separate.
Okay. Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's get Greg Addington up here from the Farm Bureau.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Greg Addington. I'm the Associate Director of Governmental Affairs for the Oregon Farm Bureau. And I, too, would like to testify in support of Senate Bill 95. I don't think I can add a lot of insight that you haven't heard from the previous two folks, but would say that, the syringes in use are used primarily by, in question, are used primarily by livestock producers and veterinarians. They can be washed and sterilized and reused. You heard there's no needle attached when they're disposed of. I think there are some concerns and maybe some legitimate concerns, and you probably hear those after me. Would just offer that we'd be willing to participate in any kind of work group or anything to try to come up with a solution to this. With that, I'll take any questions if you have any.
Are there any questions? For the Farm Bureau, and we may call you back if we dream up one. Thank you. Yes, I noticed that Representative Krupp must have wandered into the wrong hearing room or something this morning. We're in the middle of a hearing on Senate Bill 95. We'd like to welcome you. Do you have any testimony you'd like to give on this bill?
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Not on this particular piece of legislation, but the next one.
Okay, well, we'll see if we can keep you sitting there for an hour or two.
Thank you.
Okay.
I want to know where the secret plan is right now.
I see. Well, sorry, but I don't think Kristen Mitchell knows anything about the secret plan, and she's next on my list of people to testify from the recycling folks. So.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Kristen Mitchell with the Oregon Refuse and Recycling Association. We're the trade association representing the private solid waste and garbage and recycling collectors. In the state of Oregon, we also represent the people that operate transfer stations and landfills and material recovery facilities where they separate garbage or separate recyclables from other recyclables. as I understand it from the DEQ, I wasn't here at the time, but this bill was, or the law came into effect for an infectious waste in 1989, which was predates me, at least in this capacity. And since I've been working for the association, our members are some of the ones that collect and take care of infectious waste, which we also refer to as medical waste, depending on where it's coming from. Infectious waste is regulated by four different agencies: the Department of Environmental Quality, the Department of Health, ODOT, and also Oregon OSHA on worker safety issues such as potential bloodborne pathogens exposures. And the way the law is currently written, the proponent, Ms. Shalisky, I'm sorry if I didn't get that correct, is correct. Once a syringe is removed from its sterile packaging, it becomes sharp under the law. And, you know, I can't give you the reason for why that would be either. In 1989, my guess is that maybe more of these were glass. There's also the possibility that some drugs could transfer through your skin. I'm thinking maybe chemotherapy drugs or other things. So I'm guessing those might be some of the reasons behind it, but there's probably somebody better than I to answer that question. The issue for my industry and for people that collect these materials and also dispose of them is, how do we know the difference between a syringe that came from an animal husbandry practice versus maybe from off the streets of West Burnside? And if we can't tell the difference in where it came from, then we don't expect the agency that enforces it against us typically, which is the Department of Environmental Quality, but also agencies such as Oregon OSHA or ODOT, to be able to tell the difference. And then we're subject to potential enforcements. You have to imagine that you came onto the floor of a transfer station or even at the tipping place of a landfill where people inspect and watch materials that come off the trucks. And if there are syringes that aren't in packaging, then we could be subject to enforcement for not having delivered those correctly. If you have a sharps box and you collect it, the EQC allows you not to have to go through incineration of the material to sterilize it. Currently, you can take it in a sharps box and take it to a segregated place in your landfill, but you have to identify it as such, and it has to be in that particular section of the landfill. And the sharps box would then include things like this syringe. And I am sympathetic to what the proponents are saying. It makes sense to me that they're concerned about whether this material that is large is going to go in a box. It's going to cost them a lot to dispose of it. And I would hope that there might be a way that we can work with them. But our biggest issue is if we can't tell the difference, then neither can the enforcing agencies, and we don't want to be subject to fines and enforcements. Those are most of the comments that I had. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have for me.
Well, I like your suggestion that there might be a common sense way out of this. And I can't see, I mean, some of those great big syringes you wouldn't think came off Burnside.
You would hope not.
You'd hope not. But she also showed smaller ones. So, it is hard to differentiate. I see your problem. But maybe we can find a common sense solution.
I would hope so.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Question. Yes, Senator Corcoran.
I'm having a problem understanding why, from a recycler's perspective, it would matter, because all you're doing is disposing of the material. You're not disaggregating it once you get it. So why wouldn't, if you're not going to get a recycled or a syringe recycled, you'd never see it. And if it is recycled, all you do is dispose of it. So why would that be an issue for you guys? I'm having a hard time seeing that.
Well, you don't, and to my knowledge, I don't know of anyone that is recycling these types of syringes.
Right.
They're used in doctor's offices or even in veterinary practices, which I believe was considered back in 1989, because there is a section in the law that deals with veterinary practices and excludes them from this law with the exception of sharps. So those are not excluded. I'm guessing the basis for this and the reason why they're placed in those containers is more based on worker safety and health and human safety than any other reason. And, we have collectors, drivers who have picked up materials For example, I know of, I believe the hauler that was mentioned here had a driver that was collecting materials in an apartment complex here in Salem, picked stuff up, was cleaning it up alongside, and got stuck with a needle, and who knows what was in it. And so I believe it's really on the basis of safety and protection of health that you have it at all.
Right, Mr. Chair, but I guess my point is that I still don't understand why it would be of issue to the recycler, to the recycling community, if all they put in there was the actual sharp itself and not the syringe. I just don't, I'm having a hard time understanding why that would be significant.
I'm just imagining a truck that would be heading into a transfer station, say in Portland, and up till now, all the syringes plus the sharp objects have been in these sharps containers. Mm-hmm. Now, without this, all of a sudden you could see syringe parts appearing willy-nilly throughout the garbage and on the floor. If you're right that people are looking for these, all of a sudden red flags go up with them because they don't know whether that syringe came from a doctor's office with potentially contaminated blood on it, or whether it came from a vet and shouldn't be. I mean, how do you differentiate between the two? Is what,
Mr. Chair, the way I understand Mrs. Mitchell's testimony is that they are subject to enforcement if there is a syringe that is not in a sharps container. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm wondering, we need to ask the representative from DEQ, but if we were to eliminate the line right in front of the new portion in the bill that says syringes that have been removed from the original sterile containers and replace it with something like reusable syringes that the needle has been removed are not considered sharps, it seems that then the garbage enforcement people would not be subject to fines or violations if there are reusable syringes in their garbage as long as there's no needles attached to them.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Fisher.
I'm having trouble here. You mentioned that some of your Burnside constituents, and you hope they didn't use syringes of that size. I'm here to tell you, I don't believe any of your Burnside constituents that would use a syringe of any size are probably going to be carrying around a box like that to put their sharps in and paying for it. So basically what you're doing, you're penalizing the decent people, and you got those sharps in the garbage anyway. So, you know, the whole thing is a bunch of ado about nothing. Somebody's going to get stuck once in a while with something, regardless of what you do. I'll bet you they get it out of one of those containers every now and then, too.
Any other questions for Kristen? If not, let's go on. Marcia?
Thank you.
Keith, right? From the Oregon Vet Medical Association?
Chair, members of the committee, my name is Marcia Keith. I'm with Dave Barrels and Associates, and we represent the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association. I'm passing out to you just a short statement from the association in support of this bill. The principal concern with sharps is to ensure that the needle is disposed of properly according to the infectious waste disposal requirements, and when a needle can be disengaged from a syringe, then the syringe should be considered rendered sharpless and not able to pose a problem. So amending the current law, in our opinion, makes good sense. We would be happy to be part of any sort of discussion that would bring the concern about disposing of the syringe in line with our desire to get some relief from the situation, the current statutory situation. So with that, if you have any questions.
I do have one question for you. You just said relief from the current situation. Have you had other complaints around this issue from people, farmers, workers, and so on?
Mr. Chair, our veterinarians are aware that it does pose a problem for their clients, and I don't have any specific stories or examples to tell you, but it is a position that the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association Board took in support of the bill because they did perceive it as a problem.
Okay. Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bob Danko, everybody's been waiting for you from DEQ. Let's see what you have to say this morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Bob Danko with the Department of Environmental Quality. I work in the our Land Quality Division, which is the division that deals with waste and environmental cleanup, recycling, and so on. We're also interested in talking more about this, and I didn't see a representative from the Department of Health on the list to testify today, and that is going to be my first phone call when I leave here. As I understand it, the concern about syringes is that they can get back in contamination of bodily fluids, and so human syringes are part of the infectious waste law, and I think the Department of Health Services experts would be able to testify why and why that's important. The problem then becomes what Kristen Mitchell talked about, is how you differentiate between a human syringe and a animal husbandry syringe. Hopefully there's a way that we can figure out a system to take care of the concern of the proponent without bringing in the question about whether human syringes should be exempted out as well. It's out of my expertise area to talk about the health side, and that's why I think the Department of Health Services is going to be very important in this discussion. From a disposal aspect, the system seems to be working pretty well from the way we manage it with the landfills and the garbage collection and the transfer stations. So far that system's worked pretty well. It is an 89 law, and I think a lot of the concern in 89 was that syringes were mostly glass, and so you could see what could happen, syringe break and so on, it becomes a sharp. But I do think there is that issue about the contamination of the syringe when it's used, and human syringes, I'm pretty sure the health department's going to argue that should remain part of the infectious waste law.
A couple questions that occur to me. Originally, Nora referred to the fact that this doesn't seem to be equitably enforced across the state. In Marion County, she seems to be subject to one set of operating rules, and in Multnomah or Washington or somewhere up there in the metro area, they have a different one where she could take that container and take care of it herself and avoid some costs. Shouldn't there be one standard, and shouldn't the standard be applied evenly across the state? I don't understand.
I agree, Mr. Chair. I want to check further into that also, but I think it was more of a handling and collection difference than a disposal difference. I think the disposal of the red boxes are occurring the same way in landfills and in segregated or identified areas. It sounds like what's happening is that before the sharps get to disposal, they're being handled differently and put in different containers and so on. I don't think that's so much of that. I don't think that's going to be really a DEQ issue, because our issue is what happens when they're taken to the landfill and put in the ground, and are they put in a segregated area, are they in the sealed red box, and so on.
Okay. Are there other questions?
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess I would ask the issue for DEQ. It sounds like, again, and I understand you said the Oregon Health Division would want to be part of this, but the issue is more that the law says that these syringes are sharps. So for your enforcement purposes, you need to enforce it that way, obviously. If we were to remove that verbiage and say something to the line of reusable syringes that have the needles removed are not considered sharps, would that, from DEQ's perspective, solve the issue potentially?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, yes, in a very narrow sense, but I really believe that what we're going to hear from the Department of Health is that human syringes are a concern, and they should remain in the law. And then it gets a question of DEQ, how can we tell the difference between a human syringe and an animal husbandry syringe? And maybe there's a way we can work with the proponents and so on to figure out a way to do that or a system to do that.
I understand the health division concern, but from strictly the narrow DEQ position, with which, because we haven't heard from the health division, the issue is the disposal of the container, because that's what the law says, not whether or not it can be used for human, transmission, stuff like that. Is that accurate?
Yes, Senator Beyer, from a very narrow sense, if you exempted that out, and then, of course, then we would know that that's not part of the law, therefore it would be in compliance and be easy to tell. I just don't think that that's where we're going to end up, just because of the concern about human syringes.
Any other questions? Thank you. Appreciate it, Bob. I'd like to ask Nora if she'd bring those syringes back for a minute. I have what may seem like a kind of a dumb question, but how much labeling is on a syringe at the moment, and why couldn't there be simple, huge, labeling that on a syringe that differentiates between a human and an animal husbandry kind of syringe? You know what I'm saying?
I'm not real familiar with human syringes, thank God.
Or even have them of different colors, you know what I'm saying? I mean, especially on a syringe of this size, if you had, just lettering or something in color that would say, make it clear. If you saw this on the floor of a transfer station and it had a big V on it, or veterinarian or something, or words in red letters, not a human syringe. I mean, just this differentiation.
Excuse me, Senator Shields. The one thing I do not have information for you is where my veterinarian gets these, and I do not believe it's from Oregon that he purchases the syringes themselves, so that would probably involve another state manufacturer.
Mr. Chair, it appears that when you pull them apart, and if that rubber gasket was removed, there would be no chance of using it to suck bodily fluids back into it. So maybe when we get the information from the health department, maybe he decides pulling the needle off, you got to get rid of this part too in a separate way, and or maybe just that part in a separate way.
I think we may be here till August on this.
No.
Thank you for that observation, Senator Corcoran. Well, thank you for showing those to us.
Five people out in the hall or six people out in the hall and see if they can work it out.
I think you have heard the suggestion made by Senator Beyer that we send four or five of you out in the hall and work this out. It ought to be fairly simply dealt with. I do think you might want to hear from the health department before we work this bill.
Well, I think they need to. The health department obviously needs to be part of the group that is working on a solution to the issue.
How do we want to structure that?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'd sure like to have some idea. It doesn't seem to me like a bodily fluid in a container like that is much different than bodily fluid on a napkin or any other thing that you could wind up having in the trash without ever knowing about it. I know contractors that use those things to put caulking and putty in small places because they're pretty handy for that kind of thing. They don't use a needle on them, but they use a syringe, and I'm sure they aren't going to be carrying a Sharps box around. Does that box go in the landfill box and all, or do they have a new box each time? Are those boxes reusable? What's the deal?
It's a good question. Anybody want to take that on? Contractors, etc. What I'm going to suggest real quick is that affected parties just get together and come up with an amendment that works that out. I think certainly Nora could spend a couple minutes out in the hall with with Bob and Kristen and a couple others. Is that the way to do it? As soon as we can get an amendment, we can move forward with this bill. But would you guys meet out in the hall? Do you want to meet with them a second?
Sure, I can help.
Since you sponsored the bill?
Yep.
Let's just do that real quick right now. And I'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 95. I want to open the hearing on Senate Bill 242, right? And let's have Judith tell us about the bill for a second.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Senate Bill 242 allows the State Department of Agriculture employees to inspect and certify processes used in connection with horticultural and agricultural products. The key difference here is that they're certifying processes and not just products now. It adds process certification. It does authorize the department to adopt rules. It adds seeds, bulbs, and tubers that are not nursery stock. It adds that to the definition of horticultural and agricultural products. It allows the department to collect fees for the additional inspection and certification services. It specifies the fees and charges must be deposited and be continuously appropriated to the department for enforcement of related inspection statutes. The measure has no revenue impact. We have not received a fiscal impact statement yet, though I do understand that it is part of the governor's budget. And I do understand this morning from the department that they're requesting an emergency clause amendment be added to the measure. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, I'd like to hear about all of that, so let's start by getting Chuck Craig, and I think the good representative attached to his right hand there up here to talk about this. We'll start from there. And, of course, Chuck, it's totally up to you which of you gets to talk first.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much for the opportunity to be here. For the record, I'm Chuck Craig, the Deputy Director for the Department of Agriculture, and obviously to the right is our good friend, Representative Jeff Krupp. Mr. Chair, I do have two other of my staff here to help explain the bill and give a perspective from our agency standpoint.
I expect for them to clear things up after you two, done your best to
I think
topic.
That... Judith has done a good job of summarizing the bill. In effect, we have had the authority to certify products or commodities to a standard for a long time. But the market is demanding the certification of the entire process of production from seed stock through finished product now. You know, if this was cotton, we'd probably be saying from dirt to shirt or something like that. But buying
a seamless effort.
Yeah.
You set me up. I couldn't read it.
Buying entities around the world are insisting on this sort of thing for the products that they buy, and we want Oregon agribusiness to be able to do that. So that's why we're bringing the bill forward. Just a couple of things. Staff mentioned the need for an emergency clause. Representative Krupp actually graciously mentioned he'd be glad to take care of that on the House side if that's what folks want to do. And also, I just wanted to note that in my testimony, the first sentence is kind of jumbled up, and it just goes to prove that spell check can't save everybody. And, Mr. Chair, I do have Jim Kramer, Administrator of our Commodity Inspection Division here, and John Schipinski, our Assistant Director for Ag Development and Marketing, here to talk about this subject in more depth.
Representative Krupp, welcome this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's indeed a pleasure to be here. I'm State Representative Jeff Krupp, House District 17. And the reason that I'm here to add my voice to this issue is that this is a great bill that will help Oregon producers in many markets that we export to. How do I know that? Because I had the great pleasure of going on a trade mission with several growers from Oregon this October to Japan, where I have seen firsthand why this legislation will make a real difference.
Can you share a little of that with us?
I'd love to, just briefly, and I'll, as you know, I can talk forever, and I'll try to keep that to a minimum.
That's the truth.
Yes,
except
Senator Corcoran.
You have a secret plan, then we don't hear you any talking at all.
Yes, Senator Corcoran, we'll definitely have an opportunity to explore that later.
It's a different bill.
It is a different bill, much different bill. The Japanese have had a number of occurrences in the last few years that, for lack of a better term, I think this term probably illustrates the depth of the problem over there, is they're freaked out over food safety issues. They had a mad cow, scared disease problem in their domestic herd, not their imported beef, but rather their domestic beef. That plus some problems with issues related to GMO, great concern over there about genetically modified foods being used in their grocery industry, their food industry. That plus some pesticide use issues that developed from the importation of some Chinese cabbage with extreme amounts of pesticide residue on them. Also domestically that occurred too. All of these things have created a real atmosphere in Japan, which is our largest importer of Oregon-grown products. Just a tremendous concern, to the level that the Japanese Prime Minister has appointed an individual to be what in essence is a food safety czar, a cabinet-level position. And they are establishing what is, they're spending $2 billion U.S., and I think John Szczepański, who was my tour guide at ODA very ably in Japan, will share with you what this program is. They're establishing a beef identity program. They're going to give every cow that's born domestically in Japan a 10-digit code that will follow it from its birth clear through the processing, so that when the individual who goes to a supermarket looks at that piece of beef that they're considering buying, and it's pretty expensive food, it will have that 10-digit code on it. And they can actually go to the internet and they can check to make sure that that beef has been certified all the way through the process. Now, this is a rather extreme example of their government desiring to have a level of food safety on that's never been achieved before. In fact, they're going so far that they demand that the food processor that actually processes the slaughterhouse, that processes the meat, has to keep an ear for genetic material frozen for 1 year, so that if there is a problem, they have genetic material they can go back to compare with. That's how serious this issue of identity preservation is to the Japanese. What does that mean for Oregon? It means that because of the concerns about GMO foods, because of the concerns of pesticide residues, they want to know that they have a safe food supply. And this is where this program and this legislation comes into effect for Oregon growers and for the Japanese consumer. What it means is that they want to know that our food is safe from its very beginning stages of growth all the way through the processing. And this is the advantage of what this program will allow for the Oregon grower, is we're not setting up a large, cumbersome bureaucracy here to put forth a program that assures to the Japanese government and the Japanese consumer and other countries that we have safe food. But rather, it's an industry program that ODA can help us with. This is a very good, in my mind, a very good marriage as a Oregon grower myself, and having gone to Japan and met with Japanese industry food people, having met with the Japanese Ministry of Agriculture and Forestry, and having met with grocery store owners who sell our products on their store shelves, listening to their concerns. This is a very, very important issue to them. They want to know that we have a process whereby they can check to make sure that our food is exactly what we say it is. And that's what this program will do. That's why it's valuable, and that's why I would urge that you go forward and pass this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Are there any questions? Senator Fisher.
Yeah, a couple questions, Mr. Chair. Strikes me rather passing strange for a country that is willing to go out and play Russian roulette with poison fish. They're so all of a sudden all fired worried about this. It looked like they could just have another way of playing a game here if they were that worried about some of that kind of stuff. Why do they think we eat over here? I mean, do they think we want to poison ourselves and all that kind of stuff? I mean, to me, I see this thing, if you're going down to the process, pretty soon you're going to be told you got to wash your hands after you grease your combine before you can get a hold of the steering wheel. You know, I can see some of this, but perhaps we ought to put a few more qualifications on the process of making their automobiles to make sure the steering wheels are sanitized and stuff before they get them out over there, so we have some kind of an idea of what we're bringing in here. It seems to me like we've got a few things with a Japanese name on them, like Beatles and stuff like that they furnished us. I don't see them being too worried about stuff like that. I agree with you. It's nice to be able to meet the market, but somebody's going to have to lead to put a stop to some of this stuff. Because when you start talking about the processes of production, where does it stop?
Senator Fisher, I think you're asking a rhetorical question, and I'm not sure there is an answer for that except to say that, if you go to the store,
it won't be a rhetorical question when the farmer has to try to completely revamp everything, and he's overrun five times more with a bunch of inspectors.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Fisher, if I could just make a comment about that. The industry, to some degree, is already doing this. Many of the large exporters, and let's take potatoes, for instance. Lamb Weston, Simplot, they already have identity preservation processes in place. The market is responding to this, and this legislation helps our private enterprise, our entrepreneurial companies, get to that level of security that satisfies the Japanese market. And that's really what this is all about. This is not putting in place, as some other countries are doing, a more cumbersome, bureaucratic, regulatory process that I, as a farmer, would have to go through to establish an IP protocol, identity preservation protocol. This is really a much better alternative for everyone. And I think that ODA, in their further testimony, will be able to establish how this is being done already in the market. I think you should view this as an assistance to what's kind of already happening that gives Oregon growers and Oregon processors, I think, a marketplace advantage. Because other states aren't doing this, and I think the market will ultimately demand it. And if we want to keep selling products to the Japanese and other markets like them, I think we're going to have to do this. And I'm a farmer, too, Senator, and I understand these issues. And I'm going to be the first one to say that in my trip to Japan, it was obvious to us that they don't apply the same standards sometimes to some of the things that are being done domestically. And I think you bring up a very, very good point. That maybe these things are not reciprocated in the overall trade issues that we engage in with our trading partners. And in this area particularly, this is something that the market will demand. And it's because, again, the Japanese have had some serious, serious issues with mad cow, pesticide residues, and these have people extremely concerned over there at a level that never has occurred before. And that's why I think this is a really good time for us to put this program in place. This isn't a regulatory nightmare for a farmer. This is something that helps the farmers actually make their product more marketable to the Japanese.
Mr. Chair, Senator, there are those same arguments in the was ultimately called 1010.
Senator Fisher and Chair Shields, touche.
Any other questions? Well, Now we certainly need Jim and John to come up here and help clarify this issue. Is that correct?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Good to see you.
Representative, for joining us this morning.
My pleasure.
Mr. Chair, if I might just say a couple of things here while my staff is joining us. This is a voluntary program, and it's not a regulatory program. There are, in fact, private companies that perform this service for growers and processors. However, there are importing countries that we sell product to who value government certification much more highly than private company certification, and particularly Japan, Korea, some of those countries really seek a government approval or certification on product, and that's one of the reasons that we're doing this or proposing to do it.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Fisher.
Yeah. I don't happen to see the word voluntary anywhere in here. Am I missing something?
Jim, do you want to?
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Jim.
Identify yourself. For the record, my name is Jim Kramer. I'm the administrator of the Commodity Inspection Division. My division currently has the responsibility for certifying products basically under a U.S. grade standard or other types of quality product certification. They also are voluntary services for the most part, except where a grower or entity would put mandatory restrictions on, like a marketing order. But that, again, is voluntary based on what they might require. So, Senator Fisher, though it does not state voluntary in there, there's nothing requiring that they have to have any of the processes or grades mandatorily enforced upon them. It's not in the bill.
Mr. Chair, I guess I don't understand plain English. But if something's voluntary, why doesn't it have up here in the front plain stated that it's voluntary? The whole act, as I see it here, is to give authority to somebody to do these things. And it doesn't say that authority is voluntary.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senator Fisher is correct in that it doesn't state that, and we could add some language to make that more clear if that would be the desire of the committee. As stated, the statute just basically clearly defines the department's ability to certify processes in addition to products. As Senator Krupp had spoken earlier, we currently do the work and certify for the commodities that are being exported, and there's just an increased demand. Identity preserved is one of those demands that he identified. But there are others that could be out there, the biosecurity types of things, secured storage, which we're being asked to develop programs in that area too. But again, it is voluntary based on the requests that we're getting from the producers and the handlers of fresh fruits and vegetables.
Mr. Chair, if I might, I think that at least our interpretation here is that there's nowhere in the law that requires a person to subscribe to this program or to have their product or process certified by us, and that's why we're saying it's voluntary. You know, in a sense, if the buyer demands it, it's not voluntary at that step, because you just don't sell it to them if they're insisting on it and you don't have it. But as far as Oregon law requiring anybody to have a certification, the law does not do that. It just enables us to provide that service.
Further questions or comments from you two, three gentlemen?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Szczepański. I'm assistant director for the agency. I oversee our marketing program as well as our laboratory program. Let me address just some of the marketing-related issues that I believe that Representative Krupp eloquently stated. Certainly, Oregon's position in the global marketplace is not based on a notion of high production and low prices. We create a great reputation in the world marketplace because we produce better. We produce better products in better ways. And that's what the marketplace is asking for. Certainly we see it in Japan, but we see it in the United States and around the world as well, where consumers are asking more questions about the foods they eat. They're asking about the ingredients in the food, but also how the food is grown and how the food is prepared, where and by whom. And the company that can answer these questions, document these questions, and provide certification for this has a competitive edge. It's an issue in some cases of market access, that is, getting into the marketplace to play the game, but it's also an issue of achieving higher margins, and indeed that's what Japan represents. It's a very sophisticated, complicated market, but it's also a very well-paying market. That is, it's worth the hassle, in short. As Representative Krupp explained, Japan is our largest market, but in some years, Japanese buy more Oregon agriculture than Oregonians themselves purchase, making Japan extremely valuable, but also valuable in the sense that it sets trends. We see Japan asking for things this year that the rest of the world begins asking for a couple of years from now. So the concerns that the Japanese consumers are asking are not unexpected, because we see that to a degree in the United States. We see it certainly in Europe as well. In Japan, where you have a consumer heavily biased against GMO, to get into the marketplace, we need to show that products are not genetically modified. But as well, the consumer concerns about food safety are something that we can address, and it allows Oregon growers to take credit for what they're already doing. We have a very safe food supply here. We do things very differently, and I believe better than other states and many other countries. So to be able to certify, to document the processes that our growers are voluntarily undertaking, I believe this gives us a chance to take credit for what we've already got. And the handout that I provided talks about some of the things that we see in the global marketplace, specifically Japan, but indeed these are trends that we're seeing around the world. The Japanese brochure here on, actually it's a set of guidelines talking about the identity preservation requirements for certain products that have genetically modified organisms. This is not a government rule. This is not a government regulation. This is actually set by a very large association of Japanese importers. Simply put, they won't buy the product unless it carries some sort of documentation attesting to the processes and the paper trail of those products. Growers recognizing that value have voluntarily approached the Department of Agriculture because of our experience, because of our people in the field able to provide that service, and are asking for that assistance. It gives us a great honor to be able to help the growers get into the marketplace and achieve higher margins. So it's essentially whether we're talking identity preservation or documentation as to the great processes with which we grow products, it serves a great benefit to the grower and to the processor.
Thank you. A question that occurs to me, and I realize that I it's been a long time since I've been hoeing corn and all that good stuff, but Representative Krupp said we're not setting up a big bureaucracy. This is a voluntary kind of program. How does it work if it's not a big bureaucracy? I mean, how does, just give me a model of how this process would work, kind of from, excuse me, dirt to shirt, as he was saying earlier.
Mr. Chairman, the Oregon Department of Agriculture currently has seven production area districts scattered throughout the state where we're already currently certifying product. Onions and potatoes are two largest commodities, but we have others in the tree fruit district. So we already have the personnel in those districts certifying product.
Right.
And so from a standpoint of creating a bureaucracy, actually the bureaucracy is already in place meeting those needs for export currently. So we would use our current personnel with that we already have established.
And how much of the work are they doing to certify the product? That is, is it sufficient? Is the work they're doing to certify the product sufficient to certify the whole process, or how much more is going to be required of these people that you've already got in place?
Okay. Mr. Chair, currently the work is different work, actually inspecting the specimens and products to meet import requirements for pest and disease. Under a proposal like Identity Preserve Program, the producers and the packers would have a protocol of what they are doing to meet market needs, and it may be something like the land has not had GMO grown on it for 2 or 3 years. The seed source that they collected came that they're going to plant is GMO free. The isolation distances would not be conducive for pollen drift and those things. So they would have identified those traits and how they want to track them. The department would then audit those at critical control points, audit those while we're already there at the processing facility or in the neighboring fields.
Okay.
They currently, as John had stated, they currently are already doing this in most cases. If they're trying to meet those markets, especially like Japan, they're already doing that. But what the Chuck had stated earlier was that a lot of these markets want to have that official blessing on it, an independent official third-party evaluation.
They do put a higher value on a governmental stamp there than we do here.
Yes.
They're like $28.60 a pound.
Excuse me, Senator?
I'd say like $28.60 a pound.
Okay. Other.
Due to regulation.
Huh?
That's probably all due to regulation. Probably have a huge Japanese Department of Agriculture.
Any other questions or comments for the good of the order? Anything you'd like to add, Chuck?
Just another definition for you. Instead of dirt to shirt, it looks more like hoof to mouth.
Okay. Well, ask Chuck Craig to add that to his list of cliches upon which we can comment. Anything else you gentlemen would like to say this morning? I do have a question. I'm not so sure we want to leave this to the House side to put an emergency clause on. Do you want to comment about that real quick?
Mr. Chair, we'd certainly be willing to follow whatever your desires are on that.
And explain the emergency clause and the rationale, the need.
Mr. Chair,
the record.
I think that we would want the bill to become effective on passage so that we could begin doing this as soon as possible. The demand for this service has exceeded what the rate of requesting it has exceeded what we thought it would when we originally developed this legislative concept. And so in order to provide the service to Oregon companies as soon as possible, we'd like an emergency clause.
Mr. Chair, just one question.
Yes,
on that. I guess I just don't understand an agency that doesn't have what it takes to put the pesticide registration thing in order now, and you come up and say you want to do this so you can provide this service. Where's the money coming from? How do we do this with no No fiscal impact.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, this service would be paid for by user fees. We are doing some things that are somewhat similar with USDA and FDA standards for good, they're called good agricultural and good handling manufacturing processes to minimize microbial, the risk of microbial contamination to foods. And we have set a fee of $60 an hour for those services, and that's how this would be paid for.
You know any farmers get $60 an ounce?
Hey, I don't remember when the farmers the operator. Thanks a lot.
Are we going to move this puppy or not?
Do we want to move it or do we want to put a... I would like to send a complete bill to the House rather than sending it over there in one piece or another. If that's okay with you, let's draft real quick the emergency clause. Let's take a look at a fiscal just for the completeness of this public record and then move it as quick as we can. I don't want to delay it, but I don't see any reason, especially with Senator Beyer out of the room working on another bill that we started the day with. Is that okay?
Mr. Chair, that's fine with us. I just wanted to mention that we did have a person here from private industry that came to express support for the bill as well, Greg Bennett.
Well, let's give him a chance. Oh, yeah, he's on my list, in fact. So let's get Greg up here so he can comment real quick, okay? Sorry, my apologies for missing you. Kind of getting lost in the traffic this morning.
I hope he's got $60 on him.
Yeah, do you want to comment on that?
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Greg Bennett. I'm a grower, packer, shipper of onions in Western Oregon. We raise onions in Lake Labiche, some of the best soil in Western Oregon. And what we're talking about here is basically, and I know there's a lot of concern and maybe confusion in your minds of what we're asking for, but we are already doing a lot of these processes already. And since basically we're strategically located here close to the port, export has been our life support. And we have developed markets in Japan for our onions that they prefer over some onions in other parts of the country. So as these problems occur in Japan, excuse me, with their mad cow disease and other problems, they're becoming very critical about the safety of the food supply. So this is just another way that we can basically say that we believe our food is going to be as safe as we can make it.
Okay. In summary, it's kind of like you just want credit for what you're already doing.
Correct, Mr. Chair, correct. Yes.
I just kind of want to set it in that context.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
So, practically speaking, you would be, you're exporting, I presume, to Japan, you said. So, if this process was in place, there would be some documentation with your onions that go over there that say, you know, raised in Oregon by X company. That's basically
yes, sir.
The end result. Whereas now it's just they don't say anything other than
we have a group of customers that we've dealt with for several years over there, and we've developed a bond between us. They know that we can provide what they want, but as far as it going further past them to the distribution centers or the food chain stores, this will be something that will accompany with our product, that they will know that this product has been certified to as safe as it can be.
So, Mr. Chair, so this would be in hand with any Brand Oregon campaign, for instance, that we're looking at in other venues?
I believe so.
Okay.
Okay, so I want this back on the agenda either Wednesday or Friday. with an emergency clause in it and any fiscal that you can get a hold of. And it either will be on Wednesday or Friday. We'll do a work session on this. Okay? And with that, I'm going to adjourn the committee for the morning.